v. McFadden.
Counsel for the appellant, please.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, members of this honorable court. May it please the court. I am Captain Michael Schrammer, and along with Colonel Patrick Wells, we represent the appellant, Airman First Class Jessica McFadden. When a panel member equated exercising one's Fifth Amendment rights with lying by omission, and the military judge failed to grant a mistrial or exclude the member, the appellant suffered prejudice of constitutional significance.
How do you deal with the fact that, or do you deal with it? The appellant moved for a mistrial after this?
Correct, yes, Your Honor.
Did they specifically request that the member be voir dired or the member be excused?
No, Your Honor.
And does that matter in this case? Does that put it in a plain error format or?
No, Your Honor. I think the defense counsel, first of all, couldn't properly object to the member's question because the military judge had taken away that power by initially instructing the member that they could just raise their hand and ask
but the question. But the judge, defense counsel couldn't ask that the member be voir dired, couldn't ask that the member be dismissed, couldn't move that the member be dismissed. Why not?
Your Honor, could have.
He could have.
I'm just trying to establish whether we're looking at this as a plain error case or we're looking at it as
an abuse. Yes, Your Honor. I think the best lens in which to view it is that when the defense counsel had asked for a mistrial, the military judge then has a list of tools at his disposal to deal with the issue at hand.
So lesser included.
Yes, Your Honor.
Instructions are included within the mistrial request.
Well, I think the military judge at that point was on notice of RCM 912, and he has the sui sponte duty to excuse a member when that member appears.
He has the duty? Doesn't the rule say he may?
He may sui sponte excuse them, Your Honor.
Right.
But he has a duty when they've expressed a predisposition towards guilt or innocence.
Well, he has a duty to maintain control of the court, and he may have a duty to instruct, which he did. But since the rule doesn't impose a duty on the judge, and this is clearly forfeited, assuming it's not waived, then how can it be plain error for the judge not to do it sua sponte?
Your Honor, the RCM 912 is clear that any time a member has expressed a predisposition towards innocence or guilt or has not listened to the military judge's instructions, they should be excused from that.
Right, but no motion was made to excuse them.
Your Honor, I think what the defense counsel did by requesting a mistrial.
Well, you're saying it's subsumed in requesting a mistrial. I'm not so sure.
Well, I think under RCM 103, Your Honor, the defense counsel made a timely objection and at least put the military justice on notice of the specific ground that they were objecting to.
Okay, fine. Granted. Now, what about the effect of the instruction?
Your Honor, just like in U.S. v. Nash, this court's ruling, the instruction here was not adequate to, A, cure the ill that there was a prejudiced member on the panel, and B, this case is just...
Well, you're assuming it's a prejudiced member. You're assuming it's actual bias, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Isn't that up to the judge? Isn't it up to the judge to, you know... We can talk about implied bias. Obviously, this isn't an implied bias case because she just popped off in court.
Yes, sir.
It's an actual bias case or it's nothing. And you're saying that it can't be cured by a proper instruction?
Well, Your Honor, we look to see if the military judge abused his discretion. And the Air Force Court of Appeals even agreed in their decision that the member equating the Fifth Amendment rights with lying was incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously from that, we can deduce that the military judge abused his discretion in not challenging that member, or excuse me, not excusing that member.
Not excusing the member. You're saying it's beyond curing with an instruction?
Yes, sir.
And what's the basis for that assertion?
I think this court's ruling in U.S. v. Nash, Your Honor.
Okay.
When this court held in U.S. v. Nash, in that case, the military judge did voir dire the member individually. But ultimately, what the court found is the ruling for Nash ultimately had nothing to do with the individual voir dire. This court ruled in Nash that any time a member has expressed a definite opinion as to the guilt or innocence, they should be removed from the panel of members. And that's exactly what we have in this case. We have a member that has expressed a definitive opinion as to the appellant's guilt or innocence.
Where do you come up with a definitive opinion? Don't you have to make some assumptions based on her comments?
Your Honor, I think the member's her statement on its face is prejudicial. It's equating the fact that she had exercised her constitutional right with the fact that she was now lying by omission. And ultimately, Your Honor, the crux of that goes to the heart of the findings case against her. It goes to the two desertion specifications. It goes to the conspiracy to commit desertion. And then ultimately, the false statement, which is a judge of her credibility. So I think at its very heart, on its face, this statement was a definitive commentary on the appellant's guilt.
Well, if it's an actual bias case, don't we give very, very strong deference to the judge as opposed to an implied bias case?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
What role, if any, does MRE 614 have to play in this case?
Your Honor, 614 was not followed by the military judge, but followed by the defense counsel. The military judge, contrary to MRE 614, allowed the members to ask questions as they wished, just by raising their hand and asking an open court amongst the other members.
And yet the appellant has not appealed on the grounds of 614.
Not specifically, Your Honor, but the issue is encompassed in the prejudicial effect of the member's comment.
What is the remedy, if any, for not following 614?
Specifically, Your
Honor? Does our case law, the rule doesn't seem to provide an inherent remedy.
Your Honor,
Over to us on that one.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with you that the appellant has found nothing specifically on a remedy for the military judge not following 614. But I think here, the not following 614 it explicitly led to the member being able to ask a prejudicial comment. So I think both infractions are part and parcel of each other.
Did you argue 614 in your brief?
No, Your Honor.
And so should we be taking a look at it today? Or, I mean, obviously it's germane to the military judge's actions, but it appears from your brief that wasn't something you considered important.
Your Honor, it wasn't addressed in the brief itself, but it is something that the appellant considers greatly important, especially in the context of it having allowed the member to ask this question in open court. The fact that the member, even if she had asked this question in writing and presented it only to trial counsel and military judge, is still an example of her predisposition towards guilt or innocence. And that itself is error. But it is magnitude by the violation of 614 in the fact that she asked this question in open court, thus bearing that impression upon the other panel members. So this case is just like Nash, only worse.
Well, Nash was a case where they objected. They didn't object here.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, then it's not just like Nash.
And I say they did object, Your Honor.
They made a motion for a mistrial.
Under 614, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Under 614, at the next available break, 614 says you can object at that time or at the next available break.
Well, you know what I'm saying. He did not ask the member to be voir dire. He did not ask the member to be removed. He didn't do anything. Nash, they did.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So don't you think we'd be in a better position in it? You would have been in a better position if instead of jumping right to a request for a mistrial, the defense counsel had asked for the preliminary intermediate steps of asking that the member be voir dired or asking that the member be excused. It's not an all-or-nothing situation, is it?
I think asking for a mistrial was appropriate to handle. I think the defense counsel could have asked
but
for
but having, having selected that as the issue, having decided that at trial that that was the strategy that they were going to undertake, how, why are you now coming up here and complaining about the fact that he wasn't excused?
The military judge has a duty under RCM 915 before granting a mistrial to look at alternatives. And one of the alternatives this court has talked about in case law is giving a curative instruction.
And that was done in this case.
Yes, Mr. Mitchell. But he also has a duty under RCM 912 to make sure that the member, the panel member, is one that should be serving on the panel. And in this case, because of the...
But what I'm saying is you didn't ask... You didn't think that that member, you didn't request that that member not be retained on the panel, right? You didn't ask that he be questioned. You asked for a mistrial.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Good.
And when you didn't get the mistrial, did you ask that, that the member be questioned? Do you ask for any additional, anything other than a mistrial?
No, no.
You in this case means the appellant, correct?
Yeah,
just
I don't
to
mean
be
you
clear.
Personally.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yes, sir.
Just to clarify. If one were to get the prejudice, what is your prejudice argument? This was a 6-8 jurors?
Yes.
Members or whatever, and 6 needed to convict?
Yes, sir.
Okay. What's your prejudice argument?
The member's bias in this case, to the military judge's instructions, that this member had made up her mind regarding guilt or innocence. And essentially, there is no greater prejudice in our military justice system. This case is just like Nash, only worse, because here, not only did the panel member make the prejudicial comments, but she did it in open court amongst the other members. And Your Honor, you can't unring the bell.
Is there any indication that her comment would impact the other members? I mean, we don't know because we're not in the deliberation room, but you're not arguing there's direct evidence of that.
No, no. But
it's a neutral question. I'm just asking, is there any direct evidence of that? Not, it's not a trick question.
Yes, sir. And because of the constitutional significance of this case, the government has to show harmlessness beyond reasonable doubt. And that is difficult to do here because we don't know what those members are thinking. We can only assume what they were thinking based on Major Suresh's comment. In open court. And just like Nash, we are left with the fact that we have a member, although we presume that panel members will listen to the jury's instructions, that is only a presumption until demonstrated otherwise. And here, that was clearly demonstrated otherwise.
How was it demonstrated otherwise? Now, that would require you to know what went on in the deliberation room.
Your Honor, I think her question in open court on its face is a demonstration of that. The military judge instructed them being panel members, 5 separate times from Joint Appendix 26 to 29, that they should presume innocence until proven guilty, that they should not infer guilt, that they should keep an open mind to the end of the trial, and that they should impartially hear the evidence. And the panel members' question goes in direct conflict to all of those instructions by the military judge. So just like in Nash, we can't assume that by giving a curative instruction that all of a sudden this panel member is going to now listen to the military judge.
But in this case, the member didn't, for example, call the appellant a deserter, right?
No, no.
He asked a question about credibility, correct?
I would disagree that it went to credibility, Your Honor.
Well, that was the question, though, wasn't it?
It went, Your Honor, presumably to her guilt or innocence. And this court has said in the past that trial counsel or the jury members can ask an appellant when they testify, or excuse me, at this point the accused, when they testify on their behalf, questions that go to their bias or credibility. But this specific question went clearly beyond her bias or credibility. When we think of bias or credibility, they could have asked questions, testing her character for truthfulness, has she lied in the past, if they can produce 1168 showing that. But what happened here was, if we look at Prosecution Exhibit 6, clearly redacted was the reference to the fact that the appellant had asked for counsel, exercised her Article 31 rights. We had then the military judge asking questions of the accused. Did you talk to SFOI agent A and B? And she said, no, not specifically about this. Trial counsel then pops up and says, but you did talk to this third security forces investigator, didn't you? Yes. What did you tell them about remaining away permanently? At that point, defense counsel objected, the military judge overruled, and then she answered the question.
But the objection was beyond the scope, not that it might infringe on her right to remain silent or implicate or reveal her right to remain silent.
That was the military judge's ruling, but I don't think it was correct, Your Honor. In the 39A that preceded the entering of Prosecution Exhibit 6, the defense counsel was clear as to why they wanted to have that information redacted. And in the fact that the military judge then allowed that in was in direct conflict with the previous conversations that all the parties had had.
But I'm just questioning whether or not the right objection was made at that point, whether it was a beyond-the-scope objection, which, you know, maybe that wasn't beyond the scope of the way that testimony was going.
I would disagree, Your Honor. I think that based on how the evidence was coming out and the question that was being asked, I think at that point it was beyond the scope of the trial counsel to ask that additional question. But going back to the credibility factor, the appellant's credibility can be attacked. But again, this was a situation where it went clearly beyond just her credibility and bias and was going to the heart of guilt and innocence.
And why, getting back to some of the earlier questions, why would not a challenge to the member at that point have been the more appropriate course to take rather than moving for a mistrial? And then arguing that now arguing that the member should have been removed.
Your Honor, it may have been a more appropriate strategy by defense counsel to do that, but it doesn't make it an ineffective strategy. I think that the defense counsel, he acted in accordance with RCM 614, RCM 103, and ultimately the military judge should have acted in accordance with RCM 912. No further questions. I'll reserve the rest of the time.
Reserve your 4 seconds. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. Counsel for the government, please.
Good morning, Chief Judge Baker, members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Captain Richard Schreider, along with Lieutenant Colonel Catherine Oler. I represent the United States in this matter. In this case, the Air Force Court was correct. Appellant is entitled to no relief. The military judge had no obligation to sua sponte, excuse a member who appropriately questioned appellant, who was on the stand on her own behalf. And the military judge correctly denied defense counsel's motion for a mistrial before providing a curative instruction.
Can you break down your first statement, which is a military judge, the military judge had no duty to sua sponte, recuse? Excuse a member who asked an appropriate question, which sort of, I don't think anybody would disagree with that. Is it the appropriate question that's the issue, or the fact that a judge never has a sua sponte duty to excuse a member?
Well, the granted issue was, did the Air Force Corps, did they, I guess I can read
I can ask it in a different way.
Yes, sir.
When, if ever, does a judge have a sua sponte duty to excuse a member?
In a situation where actual bias is on display, on full display, or in when, as this court has said, going back into the Nash opinion, when it is a manifest injustice for him to not do so.
So in theory, if this particular member's question was, why are you guilty of sin, you would say the judge might have a sui sponte duty at that point, regardless of what defense counsel was up to excuse that member.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that
so on the continuum, you say, so it gets to whether the question slash comment was appropriate, not the sua sponte portion of the opening statement. You follow?
I do, and I think ultimately, I mean, it does always go back to the wording of the question, I believe. And the military judge, if he was presented with a situation where you're guilty of sin, I think the military judge would have a duty to sua sponte take some action there. All right. At very least, voir dire and then follow up and see.
So your argument is predicated or based on the fact that, in your view, the question slash comment from the particular member was appropriate, or in any event, did not reflect actual bias.
That is correct.
It's a question, not an answer.
That is correct. The question itself did not go to the or reveal an opinion of the, in this case, appellant's guilt or innocence.
It was a comment on staying silent, wasn't it?
Well, there was, and I think there is a distinction. There was a comment on staying silent.
Yeah, big time.
There was.
So how can you unring that bell, as appellant's counsel was saying earlier?
Well, I think the unringing of the bell, first, you would have to assume that that there was an opinion of guilt or innocence, which the government does not concede here. But the question that was ultimately asked was fair.
Well, I'm not getting into whether there's actual bias. I'm getting into what she said.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, are you arguing that it was appropriate for them to equate exercising right to remain silent to lying?
No, I'm not saying
that.
So
if you could parse out why that's not what you're saying, because it sounds like that's what you're saying.
This was admittedly, it was a very strangely worded question by the member. She inserts this statement, this incorrect, probably impermissible conclusion in the middle of it. But then she asks a question which is very fair and appropriate, which is, how is your testimony today regarding never intending to desert the Air Force permanently different from your previous pattern of deception?
But aren't we concerned with the statement and not the question?
Yeah, I think it's appropriate to look at how that question was received by the appellant in this case. And here she answered that the actual question.
The appellant doesn't have any legal knowledge. She's not supposed to say, oh, wait a minute, I'm not supposed to answer this question.
Well, and this, I think, goes to the greater picture of taking a step back. The accused appellant had taken the stand and had some very troubling aspects of her testimony throughout. And her credibility was absolutely at issue. It was the point that was still out there was whether she had the intent to remain away permanently. And the fact that the question itself was not objected to by trial defense counsel is absolutely telling. The question was...
Is it telling because it's waiver or forfeiture?
It's absolutely forfeiture, Your Honor.
Okay. So we test for plain error?
Correct.
Okay.
And the statement, while perhaps troubling, it did not impact anything. The appellant appropriately responded, as you might expect her to do. She said, no, well, it's different now because I never intended to remain away permanently. And then the members go on and continue to ask questions. In fact, there's approximately 10 questions before the natural break at a 39A session, where, as the court noted earlier, trial defense counsel didn't challenge the member, unlike in Nash, where they did challenge the member. They expressed the concern that, hey, this guy in Nash, his question shows that he's already formed an opinion regarding the accused guilt. That didn't happen either.
Why isn't it reflective of an opinion about the accused guilt to say, I have another question after this, but do you find it respectful to leave the Air Force and not obey the rules? Isn't that a bit like saying, why did you desert, or do you find it respectful to desert?
Maybe in another situation, Your Honor, but here the accused had actually pled guilty to AWOL and had taken the stand and said, well, I'm holding myself responsible for what I can. I just didn't mean to remain away permanently. She had testified that she was purposely deceptive. She had talked about some of the things that she had done to get out of her restrictive environment, to move to the hospital, to move on, to set up the phone call, to get a ride. So her credibility was squarely on display. And for the member to say, well, I think you've said that, in fact, the member could have said, you know, you've demonstrated that you're a liar. Why should I believe you? And the fact that she asked the question and gave the appellant the opportunity to respond, I think does separate it from the hypothetical that you just posed, Your Honor.
Would the judge gave a curative instruction? Would it be a different situation if he hadn't?
Yes, I do think it would be different.
Okay, even though you're saying the question was proper, that still, it would have been a different situation if he hadn't given a curative instruction.
Well, yes, Your Honor. Maybe legally, at the end of the day, it wouldn't have been different because there, in the government's opinion, there was no error. But factually, obviously, it would be different. And that goes to the discretion of
the judge. You lost me there, but that's all right.
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't MRE 614 designed to prevent this type of situation?
It does appear that that would have... would have been a little bit different if questions were written down and followed that way. But again, trial defense counsel, nobody objected to the mode and manner of witness questioning here. And in fact, there were points in time throughout this trial where this was a very active panel. And counsel had actually objected to other member questions. So that was something that the members were not... their hands were not bound. They were instructed ahead of time that yes, you may ask questions, but they're subject to objections just like everybody else's questions.
How did the curative instruction assist the military judge in making a determination as to whether the member had formed an opinion as to guilt?
Well, the entire discussion regarding the mistrial moving into why he took the curative instruction is important because the military judge said, defense, I'm denying your request for a mistrial. I am entertaining an instruction here. And trial defense counsel is actually the one that proposed, in large part, the language that was adopted and used by the military judge. When he immediately made that instruction known to the members, he gave it to him and he said, does anybody have any questions? Negative response from all members. And then he asked trial counsel and defense counsel any requests for further instructions or clarifications. And neither party said they wanted additional questions. From that point on, there is nothing in the record, contrary to appellant's assertions, there's nothing to suggest that the members could not or would not follow the military judge's instructions. So, to the point that it assisted the military judge, I think the absence of any other evidence to the contrary does bring this absolutely into the military judge handled it properly, and absent evidence to the contrary, we can assume that the members followed the military judge's instructions.
If a member had informed an opinion as to guilt, would the judge have had a duty sua sponte to excuse them?
I think it
don't argue perfect. Facts, argue law.
Yes, Your Honor. The military judge has, or the an appellant, an accused, has the right to a fair trial. And as this court held in Nash, that extends to a fair and impartial panel. So, had this question...
In the abstract,
I think...
You're teaching a class at the JAG school, and the question is, well, what if a member has informed an opinion as to guilt? What should the judge do? What is the judge required to do? What is your response?
Your Honor, the appropriate measure would have been for the military judge to voir dire the member flesh out the facts and find out whether there was an actual bias or implied bias. Because with regard to the actual bias...
Now, you're saying voir dire, but my question's saying that they have informed, that they have an opinion as to guilt. You're saying still voir dire them and say...
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
In the event it is firmly established, I think the military judge would have an obligation to excuse that member.
And then what triggers that duty to voir dire? Is it an indication that a member may have formed an opinion?
If there is a concern, yes, Your Honor.
And you don't think there's a concern here?
Not with regard to the guilt or innocence, no, Your Honor. And I think the AFCA got it correct in their analysis and their ruling here when they said the question, the troubling statement before the question, I think is more accurate, but that troubling statement indicated, you know, the credibility was on issue here of the appellant. And again, that's not something where, you know, an 1168 written statement was put into evidence and then there's comments and questions about somebody's right to remain silent. This is a situation where the accused appellant took the stand, voluntarily subjected herself to questions from everybody, and put her credibility on front and center of everything. So to ask that member, or to ask the appellant, hey, explain to me why I should leave you, that is absolutely a fair question.
But that wasn't the question, was it? And it wasn't a question when it came down to this issue of lying by omission. It was, in fact, a statement made by the Magus Arrest, the panel member. Shouldn't that cause us concern as compared to if the panel member had asked, isn't it a situation where we should interpret it this way? Could it be viewed as Magus Arrest was purposely being adversarial?
Maybe. That is a good point, Your Honor. But I think the fact, and it goes back to one of the earlier questions, the accused isn't expected to be as knowledgeable about the law as the people in this room, and neither is Magus Arrest. She had been given some preliminary instructions about how to do her job and had not yet been instructed with regard to findings. So she was simply performing her duties as a military member. She might have put some troubling language before that perhaps incorrectly drew a legal conclusion that was permissible, but it didn't necessarily display that she was inflexible, or that she had implied, or that she had actual bias towards the member or the accused here.
Now, in terms of her putting forth this information, as you stated, that was a direct result of the military judge authorizing this approach to the questions rather than doing it consistent with the military rules of evidence. So when defense counsel says, make a motion for mistrial, wasn't defense counsel looking at a situation where the military judge had already laid the foundation that permitted the trial counsel to ask the question about her Article 31 rights, and then saying, and now Magus Arrest is saying this in front of the other panel members? Doesn't that provide a broader view of what happened here and why a motion for mistrial wasn't something that was unreasonable by defense counsel?
Well, Your Honor, I think the request for a mistrial, certainly it is a reasonable request by the defense counsel.
So once we get to there, though, doesn't it say that when it comes to a motion for mistrial, it's appropriate for a military judge to look at what other avenues would be appropriate to address the problem short of a mistrial?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's exactly what happened here. The military judge allowed the trial defense counsel to make their request, their motion for mistrial, voice their concern. And the concern voiced by trial defense counsel was that at this time, pursuant to RCM 915, we believe it's manifestly necessary in the interest of justice. And they pair it back, essentially, they mimic the language of 915.
But they refer to the fact that there had been this improper questioning to begin with.
Right. They refer to the line of questioning and then saying, this is why we're asking for a mistrial. And this puts it squarely in the military judge's discretion on whether to grant a mistrial, whether it's appropriate. And here, the military judge allowed them to voice his concern, denied the motion, but then took the next step of saying, but I will entertain an instruction. Sought input from trial defense counsel, and I think that's important here because trial defense counsel, as I noted earlier, actually did essentially draft this instruction that the military judge ultimately gave to the members. So the military judge, while he denied the ultimate request for a mistrial, he did take a lesser appropriate remedy after seeking input from trial defense counsel itself to satisfy their concern. So that, I think, makes it entirely an appropriate decision by the military judge, even if it was not necessary.
Even if what was not necessary?
Even if it was not necessary to give an instruction in light of the fact that
you don't think it was necessary to give a curative instruction in this case?
I think it was appropriate, Your Honor. I think the way everything unfolded, I don't think that it was necessary, but I do believe that once the trial defense counsel voiced a concern, raised a concern, although it was eventually later in the 39A session, not at the time, once the defense counsel voiced a concern, I think it was an appropriate step for the military judge to make.
So what's the difference between appropriate and necessary?
And it might be, Your Honor, it may be slicing the bologna very thin on something like this, but I think it's necessary if it's going to impact an appellant or an accused's right to a fair trial, and I think it's appropriate if it's a correct statement of the law and it will help the members do their jobs. And I believe that this was in the appropriate category. In conclusion, the military judge had no obligation to excuse Major Suresh based on her question. The military judge correctly denied the defense counsel's request for mistrial, and any conceivable error was cured by the military judge's specifically tailored instruction. The Air Force Court did the job this court asked it to do. It viewed this case in light of United States v. Nash and correctly determined that appellant was and is entitled to no relief.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, opportunity for rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, when the defense counsel asked for a mistrial, that was an appropriate request considering the magnitude of the panel member's question. Defense counsel substantially complied with MRE 614 and MRE 103, and at that point put the military judge on notice of his requirements under RCM 912. And at that point, the military judge should have excused a military member who expressed a definitive opinion as to the guilt of the appellant.
Well, should they have excused him, or should he have at least made inquiry?
Your Honor, the military judge should have excused the panel member that asked the question. The military judge then should have voir dire the additional panel member.
So there was no need to voir dire the panel member who made the statement, in your opinion?
Your Honor, I think the military judge could have. I don't think there would be anything inappropriate about that. But based on this court's opinion in Nash, I don't think there's much that the panel member could have said at that point to make yourself an available member to serve on that panel.
Counsel, do we have to agree with you that the question that was asked was a definitive expression of guilt, you know, that they believed that the appellant was guilty in order for you to win?
Your Honor.
Do you understand what I'm saying? I mean, there's you're not suggesting that that by the time a bunch of evidence has been put in, that a member can't start to have questions as to guilt, right? You're not suggesting that they can't begin to have any opinion whatsoever, are you?
Your Honor, maybe they can begin in their own minds to deliberate on the evidence.
Or to have a big concern, for instance, as to whether someone is credible, right? And even if ultimately that will determine whether they're guilty or not, it's not the same thing, is it?
Your Honor, they are different, but I think in some ways they are one of the same. For example, they can begin to view the evidence or take it in and to themselves judge the credibility of the witnesses, but they can't begin to make presumptions until they begin their deliberation. And the military judge, in this case, specifically told them that on JA pages 27 to 29, that they had to keep an open mind when hearing all of the evidence.
Right, but it doesn't mean that they can't have a question, right?
They can have questions, Your Honor. And
so that goes back to my question to you, which is, if we don't agree with you that the question that was asked of the appellant was, in fact, an expression of a definitive belief of guilt, that do you win or not win?
Your Honor, I think the appellant could still win even if you don't believe it was a definitive statement, because the specter of the statement was still raised, and it still left that fact to the military judge that even if he didn't believe it was a definitive statement, he still had to deal with that specter.
Yeah, but he dealt with it by instructing. Doesn't that change the complexion?
It does not, Your Honor. The instruction in this case was insufficient to cure the prejudice.
But it was the instruction that the appellant requested, right?
Your Honor, it was the best of a bad situation. After their remedy to the military judge was shot down, it was the next best thing that they could do to keep pressing with the trial and have some semblance of the ability to go forward. But not a perfect world.
Thank you, counsel.
The appellant's court-martial was prejudiced when the military judge abused his discretion by not dismissing a panel member who demonstrated that she could not keep an open mind until the close of evidence, presumed guilt, and was unable to follow the military judge's instructions. Thank you.
Thank you. The court thanks both counsel. The case is now submitted and will stand in recess until 10:15-ish. Thank you very much.
Court stands in recess until 10:15.